Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When suicide bombers attack military checkpoints, it's hard to focus on the rules of war. When soldiers at those checkpoints aim high-explosive 25-millimeter cannon fire at an unmarked vehicle loaded with Iraqi women and children, it's hard to imagine there are rules of war. Yet the U.S. military has some 600 lawyers in the field with the troops in the Gulf trying to bring some sense of legal propriety and reason to a situation that seems at times to lack any reason at all. The rules, experts say, don't change over time, but the interpretations do. Civilians have many rights in a combat zone until they pick up arms. Prisoners also have rights, unless they're thought to be spies. And who can shoot and what can be shot at are all issues under the Geneva Conventions, the rules of war, and then, for each different encounter, the rules of engagement. Connection listeners, how important is it for the U.S. military to listen to its lawyers, particularly at a time when the Iraqi forces appear willing to use any means of combat? Are there rules in war today? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we will be talking today with Scott Silliman, who spent 25 years offering legal guidance to the U.S. Air Force. He oversaw the work of all the lawyers that deployed in the first Gulf War. And today, Scott directs the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University's Law School in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Dick. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, welcome back to The Connection. Now, tell me, of these hundreds of lawyers deployed with the troops in Iraq, will there already have been a lawyer assigned to the case where the 7 or 8 or 9 women and children were shot yesterday?
Dick, that incident is clearly under investigation. I think it's going to be more a question of whether the rules of engagement were properly followed, whether the soldiers, as they saw that van approaching, followed the proper procedures and employed self-defense when they fired. After all, reasonable measures were taken. And my guess is that in the end result, we're going to find that that soldier acted as reasonably as he could, all things being considered. So there's not going to be any prosecution or anything like that resulting from that incident.
But a lawyer would be working on it now already, yeah?
Yes, I think a lawyer obviously is going to be an advisor to the group that's investigating. And again, I would stress that lawyers forward deployed in situations like Iraq, as they were 12 years ago in the Persian Gulf at that time, are advisors to commanders and advisors to pilots who have questions as far as proper targeting and what they can and cannot do. And they are one of a host of advisors to the warfighting commander, including munitions experts, intelligence officers, and the like.
Do you mean, Scott, by advisors that if there are some Iraqi soldiers or paramilitaries holed up in a hospital and shooting out, and the commander on the ground has the opportunity to go up the line and say, what are my options here, that one of the pieces of advice that he'll be getting or that'll be going to his commanding officer will be a lawyer who knows the details of the Geneva Conventions, that sort of thing?
That certainly could be the case, Dick, but more probably in the pre-war scenarios and in the training exercises, lawyers were involved in ensuring that all the sailors, soldiers, Marines, and airmen are aware of what the Geneva Convention and the Hague regulations say with regard to different situations, when you're confronting what appears to be a civilian, or what can you do when soldiers are hiding in a mosque or a religious site of some sort. All these hopefully are worked out in advance, but certainly lawyers over there are obviously available throughout the command structure for on-the-spot advice.
Now, the lawyers that you supervised in the first Gulf War, that was the first time that the U.S. military had worked with this integrated system of actually having lawyers giving this sort of combat advice. Is that right?
I think so, Dick. Of course, the integration, the systematic integration of legal advice with combat decision-making goes back to the mid-70s, when lawyers of all the services started working with their respective combat arms in training exercises and integration of it. The law of war briefings, that originated from the Geneva Convention started to be given on an annual basis in all the services in the mid-70s. So we were working towards that incident in the Persian Gulf War where, for the first time, lawyers forward deployed in large numbers. The combat decision-making on targeting, on what you could do in the rules of engagement, incorporated illegal advice, and I think that that was a splendid instance of our forces in a nation which touts itself to be under the rule of law, actually applying that rule of law in combat.
So tell me what you're thinking about what we're seeing and hearing from Iraq over the past week or so, because there seem to have been, in that short period of time, so many questions involving rules of war, rules of engagement. So many times the Geneva Conventions have been dragged off the shelf by people like me who don't really understand the fine points. But, it, you know, with all the involvement of civilians and with all the questions about tactics, this is becoming a principle, sort of principle importance in understanding this war.
Dick, I think you're exactly correct, but for two different reasons. One, obviously, we are concerned when we see our prisoners of war being paraded before Iraqi television, and we say, is that or is that or not a violation of Article 13 of the Geneva Convention? And then we hear from the other side, the Arab street, well, how can you promote the rule of law and suggest that we're violating it when you yourself are doing the same thing in Guantanamo Bay? I think all of your listeners need to understand that what's going on the battlefield in Iraq is important, but also this whole question of the propaganda war, how the embedded media in our side and how Al Jazeera and the other networks are helping to shape world opinion. And in touting the Geneva Conventions and the rule of law in violation and in compliance, both sides are trying to get the high moral upper ground in world opinion, which ultimately will be what determines whether the United States was right or wrong in going into Iraq.
So although what we're dealing with are the phrases put into the Geneva Conventions, what you're saying is what really counts in the long run is world opinion and who's able to hold and defend that moral ground.
I think that's clearly the case, Dick. Now, certainly there are egregious violations of the Geneva Convention. Certainly, if in fact it's proven that our prisoners of war, American prisoners of war, were executed, that would be a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, which could result, should result, in a war crimes prosecution of some sort. But the immediate impact, as I see it right now, is shaping world opinion in recognizing that the United States and British forces are, in fact, entering into combat, using arms in total compliance with international law, and the Iraqis are not. And yet they are trying to make the same instances reflect the other way. So very, very much a shaping of world opinion or an attempt to shape world opinion for one side or the other.
I wonder if I can get the lawyer part of you to listen to a paragraph from this morning's editorial in the Arab News. It's a paper that's published in English in Saudi Arabia, and it goes like this, Scott. It says, in a war like this, a war which for ordinary Iraqis is one of national survival, all methods are fair. If guerrilla tactics are the only serious option available to them, it's folly to imagine that they're not going to use them. If American and British strategists genuinely imagined that they would play the war according to West Point and Sandhurst rules, it is another miscalculation to add to the list. Is that a point of view which is legally defendable?
No, it's not, if you're asking for the lawyer in me, Dick. When you talk about West Point rules, we're not talking West Point rules or Sandhurst rules. We're talking about international law, the Geneva Convention, which all three parties to this conflict are bound by, Iraq, Britain, and the United States. And it doesn't really matter what the other side does. The obligations under international law, which are fundamentally, Dick, basically humanitarian law, mm-hmm, to keep civilians out of harm's way. These are unilateral in that they apply regardless of what the other side does. So to suggest that, well, when your back is against the wall, when your country may not survive, you should abandon the law and use whatever force is available to you is to throw out any kind of constraint on armed warfare, and the Geneva Conventions in that situation would call for prosecution thereafter for anyone who takes that particular approach.
But if we pull back our perspective a little bit to one that's broader than just the lawyer's perspective. If I understand what you're saying, Scott, you're saying that the Iraqis do have some ground to stand on when they're saying, why are you guys here? The Brits saying they're in there for disarming the country, the Americans saying they're in there to change the regime or for self-defense. The reasons for the war become shaky, so then the reasons used to justify tactics in the war are equally shaky.
Well, Dick, what's important is to point out that in international law, there are really two separate but to some extent interrelated parts. The first is what we call the jus ad bellum, and that's this question of when can one nation, one state, use armed force against another.
That's justification before war,
that's
right?
That's exactly correct. That's this whole debate that you and your listeners have been discussing on preemptive self-defense the United States is using, and whether that is regime change or disarmament, and which is the legal and which is the illegal. Now, totally apart from that, Dick, once a state enters into armed conflict, then the other part of international law becomes the dominant aspect, and that's what's called the jus in bello, and that's how much force and what type of force can be used and against what type of objects or what type of structures. That is where the law comes as far as you must only target military objectives, combatants. You cannot target civilians. We've heard about that. This is this whole question of the incident that occurred at the checkpoint, whether that soldier targeted civilians. Obviously, he didn't. He didn't know there were civilians in that van when they were coming. The whole issue will basically come down to whether he employed rules of engagement and fired a warning shot in time for it to be heard. But that's not a violation of the jus in bello. To target a civilian marketplace, which the Iraqis are alleging we might have done, I don't think we did, but we might have done, that would be a violation of the jus in bello. To target a church or a cultural site, a violation of the jus in bello, which is quite a different issue from whether the United States and Britain are properly engaged in force.
And if the Iraqi side chooses to characterize its defense as national survival or put it in the same context of a popular uprising a la, you know, the what the Palestinians are doing now, or what the IRA said it was doing, or the ANC said it was doing in South Africa, none of that changes.
No, and the law does not change depending upon the circumstances, Dick. Now, it needs to be said, of course, that regardless of what the Iraqis do, regardless of what tactics that they adopt in this march towards Baghdad and to try to defend their country, that does not in any way diminish our obligations to comply with the law. And to a larger extent, Dick, I don't think Americans and the Western world want this country or Britain to lower its standards as far as how it fights just because the other side does it. There is a much larger moral standing that's at stake than just the winning of a particular battle.
So the whole no rules in a knife fight notion doesn't stand here when you've got a force that's duly over there and conducting a war such as they are.
That's exactly correct, Dick.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, is it a new kind of war? Is it one where one side has such overwhelming force that the old rules of war are being bent? In your view, we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. In our conversation this hour about the rules of war, the rules of engagement, it's certainly hard for the politicians and the journalists and the generals and the lawyers. It's also hard for the soldiers on the ground. One soldier in the Army's 3rd Infantry Division was talking yesterday to NPR about knowing just how to distinguish the enemy.
I would rather fight a force where it's a uniform force. Here they are. You know, there's no more dilemmas on whether or not that's a civilian or whether or not I shoot or not. You know, it's clear cut. There's the enemy. He's shooting at me. I'm shooting at him. It's much easier mentally. to fight a uniformed enemy that you know, here's a Republican Guard.
Soldier speaking yesterday from the front line with the 3rd Infantry Division. Our number, 1-800-423-8255. Scott Silliman is with me. He's a professor of the practice of law at Duke University School of Law, also executive director of the Law School's Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. Let's take our first caller from Imroe, South Carolina. Bob's joining us. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Hi, Scott. Haven't seen you. We had that conference on desert illness up there with the judge.
All right, Bob.
I was the guy that sort of got the ball rolling on that. I'm a retired infantry major. I started out as a private in the Marines. And even back in 63, we got lectures on, you know, because of the nature of the war in Vietnam, who and what and all that. And I had personal experience knowing a Lance Corporal was on a garbage truck run from Da Nang, had a youngster throw a hand grenade at him, which he killed the youngster. You know, you don't do that kind of stuff, obviously, if you can avoid it. But bad things happen in combat. And I feel very bad for the people that were involved in this, not only the Iraqis. I've got friends that are Iraqis. On the other hand, those soldiers that were involved are going to have nightmares for the rest of their lives about it. I mean, they're going to feel bad just being Americans. They don't go around shooting innocent women and children.
Bob, are you saying that setting aside what's enshrined in the Geneva Conventions and the other international law, that being a soldier, being on the front line, means that you have to make snap decisions and you just hope that those are decisions that are informed by what you've been trained up until that point?
That's right. I mean, I'm all speaking all the way from being a private to being a retired major.
Mm-hmm.
There were classes given constantly by the JAG people, you know, whenever something was going to be happening about what the latest rules were, you know, what to do and all that. And yet, in the final analysis, it's the private sitting there with a weapon at a roadblock that's got to make a decision, and you hope he does the right thing. And obviously none of us were there, and there's going to be an investigation. You know, people will figure it out and do the best they can, but it's still bad.
Scott, is that about the way that you see it?
Yeah, I do, Dick, and I want to reinforce something that that Bob said, is that when you talk about the rules of engagement and the lawyer's briefing before you get into a conflict, one of the most important cardinal principles that must be embedded in every rule of engagement from the very top peacetime rules for the United States down to that individual unit is self-defense. Now, the problem is for that young private that Bob was talking about is I have got to be able to perceive that somebody coming at me is, in fact, a threat to me. It's not an old woman or children. It is, in fact, some kind of a combatant, even though they're not guised in a particular uniform. But if in doubt, Dick, that self-defense always will take priority. And if that soldier feels himself threatened, legitimately threatened, a reasonable belief, then the law will always support him, from the Geneva Conventions on down to any potential criminal charges that may be brought against him.
All right, Bob, thanks for that call. Let's go to Concord, Massachusetts now. Jeff's on the line. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, yeah.
Thanks for calling.
What I wanted to talk about was there seems to be this expectation in the U.S. media that we want to see the combatants dressed in their uniforms, and we think that they are, you know, somehow being sneaky and not playing by the rules of war if they're dressed in civilian clothing. And yet there are two cases against that, one of which is that we have special forces there dressed in civilian clothing, and we don't seem to mind that. But the other is that you can't expect to invade another country and expect everybody who's opposed to you to be dressed in a uniform. Mm-hmm. If somebody invaded my country, even though I'm not in the military, if I had a gun, I would shoot at them.
And I think, Scott, in the definition of a combatant in the field, if a civilian like Jeff were to pick up a gun to defend his home or Concord, that he then becomes a combatant, right?
You're correct, Dick. There's what's in the law referred to as a levy en masse, which is when the civilian population rises up almost spontaneously to take up arms against an invading force without having time to form themselves into regular units, then, in effect, they become combatants in a way, but they also are protected if they're captured as prisoners of war. That's one of the categories under Article 4 of the Third Geneva Convention. But more importantly on what Jeff is saying, he does raise an excellent question of this kind of hypocrisy, as it were, that's being suggested by Al Jazeera and other on the Arab street. And I think the reference goes back to special ops folks, especially in Afghanistan, where many in the in this country saw pictures of special ops troops that were bearded in civilian dress, mm-hmm. and the argument was made, oh, you can't distinguish our special ops folks from civilians, then how can you complain about the Iraqis in their battle. My understanding, Dick, is that the Pentagon's view on that particular incident was that our Special Forces troops were actually dressed as Northern Alliance troops, and that there was, in fact, some way to distinguish them from the civilian. But that may be a distinction without a difference. The lawyers may be correct, but the public opinion may suggest that we may be appearing to do the same thing. So it is a confusing area. Nonetheless, if you've got a civilian coming at you, or what appears to be a civilian, with a Kalashnikov or some kind of a weapon about to fire at you, the rules of engagement are going to tell that young private to fire in self-defense, and that's an appropriate and a legal response.
All right, Jeff, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Durham, North Carolina now, and Camilla's on the line. Hi, Camilla.
Hi. One thing that's really bothered me in the battle for public opinion is the way people have been throwing around the word terrorism. I've noticed it twice. Most recently, I think it was Rumsfeld saying something about the tactics of terror, and it seems like, well, what terrorism means to me is attacks on civilians, but I think Americans have a real gut reaction to terrorists, and if we can associate the things that the Iraqis are doing with terrorism, that would sort of give us more justification for what we do back. The other time is when the American soldier threw that grenade in to the officer's tent or whatever, and they said, we thought originally it was just a terrorist, but if it's an attack on military people, that just doesn't seem like terrorism to me, and it seems like, what does that word mean anyway?
We kind of have to assume, don't we, Camilla, that the language that's being used by the political and senior military leaders on both sides is a part of the battle itself. I mean, if the Iraqis choose to talk about the American soldiers as mercenaries, you know, we hear that and kind of go, yeah. And at the same time, if Donald Rumsfeld chooses to talk about people as death squads, isn't that kind of like part of the same I don't know, verbal warfare back and forth, Scott?
I agree, Dick. And Camilla does have a point, though, because this concept of terrorism, of course, becomes very, very important when we go back to that first part of international law that you and I talked about, the jus ad bellum, because President Bush, a little over 2 weeks ago on that Monday night, clearly wanted to draw the linkage between al-Qaeda and terrorism and Saddam Hussein as a reason for our invocation of preemptive self-defense. So Don Rumsfeld and the others in the administration are going to continue to suggest that terrorism is very much a part of what's going on in Iraq. However, when we get to armed conflict, which is where we are right now in Iraq, that political distinction, that linkage becomes less important than this jus in bello concept of what we can do in armed conflict. And to some extent, the Geneva Convention does not recognize terrorism as one of the parts of its rubric of governing international law. Matter of fact, this whole war on terrorism flounders in international law because the law has been outstripped by terrorist movements and what we're dealing with in this country. So when we're dealing, again, with civilians that take up arms against us, whether they're terrorists or not, they become subject to self-defense measures by our troops. And the way I understand that incident with the American soldier and the grenade into the tent, that is a classic issue under military justice, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. He's presumed innocent. He'll be given a fair trial, a court-martial trial, if evidence does support that type of charging. And certainly that is in no way a terrorist activity. It is more a criminal act conducted by one soldier against his comrades and will be dealt with as such.
Let's go back to the first thing that you picked up on from Camilla's observation, though, Scott. about, and that is the war on terror and the war in Iraq, because if the two are mixed together as we've heard them mixed together, does that make it more difficult to come up with the interpretations and the definitions that are so important in a lawyer's mind?
Yes, it does, Dick. Again, if you start talking in terms of terrorism and the war on terrorism, as all your listeners are familiar with and dealing with what we're doing in Guantanamo Bay and what we're doing in this country as far as detaining people without access to a lawyer, without being charged, it's very, very difficult to mix that with a clear situation of recognized armed conflict with state parties, i.e. Britain, the United States, and Iraq, in what's going on over there in the movement towards Baghdad. Terrorism does not have a state component. It may have state sponsorship, but it's not one state. It's a terrorist group or terrorist individuals. And so to mix the two greatly confuses the issue, but there should be no confusion as far as the rules that govern the use of force and the targeting in Iraq. That is not an issue of terrorism. That's an issue of the Geneva Convention, the Hague regulations, and what our soldiers can do and their soldiers can do in a state of armed conflict.
But doesn't it even become complicated? You've just said what their soldiers can do and what American soldiers can do. That's defining them as soldiers. You take these fedayeen paramilitary people who are apparently fighting either in uniform or out of uniform, and I read someone suggesting today that that's the sort of group which might continue its attacks on the United States long after the war is considered to be over. Where do they fit in a definition that you'd be searching for?
Dick, they would be considered unlawful combatants, which means that they would be considered to be civilians who have taken up arms but do not wear uniforms. They do not comply with the rule of law. They do not carry their weapons openly, and they apparently do not have any supervisory channel, which is the classic definition of a lawful combatant. But to say that they are an unlawful combatant is not also to say that they're a terrorist. It says that they're an unlawful combatant, just like the German saboteurs back in 1942 who came upon our shore with the intent to destroy some of our defense facilities. They were not terrorists, but they were unlawful combatants, and they were prosecuted by a military commission and upheld, and that prosecution was upheld by the Supreme Court.
But if all the fedayeen are unlawful combatants, does that mean that they are somehow outside of the rules of war, the definitions of a prisoner or a soldier in the Geneva Conventions?
Well, if you wanted to try to group them all, I'm not sure you could definitely do that. We have grouped Al-Qaeda, a terrorist organization, as unlawful combatants with regard to the Geneva Convention and the protections of the Geneva Convention and how they can be prosecuted, in other words, by a military commission but not by a court-martial. When we're talking about the Fedayeen Saddam, they have more a guise of an armed force rather than a terrorist organization, and although they, too, are unlawful combatants or may be deemed to be lawful combatants, to make the direct equation that they are also a terrorist group, I think, is incorrect.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Camilla, thanks for calling in. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina now. Anthony's on the line. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how you doing today?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome. I'm a former captain from the 82nd Airborne Division, and I'd just like to go back to the rules of engagement issue with the killing of civilians yesterday.
Yeah.
It's very unfortunate that something like that happened, and I can feel for those soldiers who were engaged in that action yesterday. But I hope that our listeners realize that the 82nd Airborne Division and the 101st Airborne Division are the best-trained soldiers in the world when operating with or against paramilitary forces on a large-scale level, your brigade and your battalion, brigade, and division-sized operations that they're doing now. They're the best trained in the world and the most disciplined on how to take on those forces. Yesterday's action, and I'll be brief here, yesterday's action, when you have a soldier at a checkpoint and he's maybe hasn't slept for the last 48 or 72 hours because he's in a combat operation, which is very regular, and they train very regularly in those kind of conditions, and they see a vehicle coming at them, whether it's 15, 20, 30 miles an hour, they're trying to analyze within very few seconds how fast that vehicle's coming,
right.
what kind of danger is it, if it has an explosive on it, how big is that blast radius. And so they've got to make a decision very quickly, and they've got to be able to analyze how much of a threat is it to their checkpoint, to other people around there, to other civilians, innocent civilians maybe passing through that checkpoint. And that's where the difficulty comes, but realize that under our ROE and our rules of engagement, they're very well trained on it, and they're taking the best action as possible. Nobody can judge their decisions unless they've been there in that position. And being in the Middle East on peacekeeping operations, under stricter rules of engagement than this because of being in peacekeeping operations where we could not even load a round in the chamber of our weapon until we were fired on, it's a very difficult position that they're in, and acting in self-defense is exactly what they need to do. And
Anthony, I want to ask you a question about that, because one reason we're talking about it today is that there are reporters who are right up there on these checkpoints as part of the embedding thing, and that's, you know, that's a notion that the Pentagon thought would be a good way of helping people understand what's going on in the war. Without that, we wouldn't have the level of detail that we have this morning about what happened, how many people were involved. I'm not suggesting for a minute that it'd be swept under the carpet. All I'm saying is that it's forefront in the news simply because there are so many reporters there. What's your view of the fact that you can take a single incident like that and it becomes, in effect, the story from the Iraq battlefield of the day? I mean, does that make it a lot harder on the soldiers who are there?
Well, I think of course, the media wants to report the most emotional and shock type news that people want to listen to, and that's what comes up first, especially with the last couple of days or last 5 days of this paramilitary conflict that continues to increase. And so, of course, that's going to grab people's attention. I think what you heard from the Washington Post reporter saying that the company commander, you know, screamed at the lieutenant over the radio, saying you didn't fire warning shots soon enough, you just killed civilians, I think that's human emotion. I think that's human shock in that a tragedy was just caused. I don't think it was necessarily, and I can't say because I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Where was the company commander? Was he in visibility of what was happening? Was he 200 kilometers back? Where was the platoon leader? Where was that platoon leader's sergeant that was probably guarding the checkpoint? Most likely that was an infantry squad of a sergeant and some enlisted personnel guarding that checkpoint. So where were these people on the battlefield when that communication was made? And I think it was just the human emotion of, oh my gosh, what just happened? Because they're in the middle of battle, in the middle of conflict, and they have emotions, and they're going to be expressed verbally, of course.
No, I hear what you're saying, and when you get that one snapshot of the event, it will leave some things off on the margins. Anthony, thanks for calling, and nice to have you on the program. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, a conversation about the rules of engagement and the rules of war, and whether or not the conflict that we're reporting on and talking about is in some way bending those in ways that you think conform to what's changing on the battlefield or something that makes you uncomfortable. We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me this hour, Scott Silliman. He is Executive Director of the Duke University School of Law Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. Scott spent 25 years as a judge advocate in the Air Force, retiring with the grade of colonel in 1993, and during Desert Storm was the Air Force's most senior attorney. And, you know, Scott, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts about part of the conflict that we haven't discussed, and that is the air war, because if we look at how much the technology has changed since the days when, you know, B-52s carpet bombed Vietnam, and now we have all these precision laser and satellite-guided munitions, do the interpretations of the rules of war change with the technology?
I think the interpretations do change, Dick. You're exactly correct. And with precision-guided munitions as we have now, when you can bring a satellite-guided weapon down within 5 feet of where you want to put it, and the choice of munitions is such that you can have a computer modeling and you can take out the inside of a building without blowing out the glass windows in that building. And many of your listeners may then say, well, if that's the case, if we have this precision-guided ability, are we required under the law to use those munitions rather than the stores of what we call dumb bombs from B-52s? And the answer is no. The fundamental law of the Geneva Convention and the Hague regulations going all the way back to 1907 has fundamentally not changed, Dick. And it says, again, that in an attack, in targeting, that you clearly must go against a military objective. Clearly must go. You cannot target civilian targets, as we said before. But the second calculus in that is that when you have a military target that's clustered within civilian property or civilians, then the military commander must refrain from launching an attack if the incidental loss of civilian life, injury to civilians, or damage to civilian objects would be excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage anticipated. Now, an easy case stick would be a school children, in a 100 school children, around one Iraqi soldier. Could you use a bomb that would kill all to take out that one Iraqi soldier? Clearly not. But it becomes very, very more difficult when you're dealing with, say, 4 or 5 or 6 Iraqis or 10 or 20 within a civilian community. And so the commander must make the best judgment he can. But going back to Anthony's point, which was such a good point, that when you're dealing with young troops, no matter how well trained they are, in the intensity, the emotional intensity of conflict, all we can ask of them is to make the very best judgment they can based on their training. And yes, there are going to be problems in war. There are going to be accidents that happen. The law is only concerned with the intentional disregard of all that training. That's what's the appropriate aspect of it.
And when we hear reports of a bomb, a supposedly smart bomb that goes awry, that lands in a marketplace, and I know there's still some dispute about whose bombs landed where in Baghdad, and obviously that's part of the issue as well. But if the smart bombs aren't smart, does that mean that from the perspective of judging it based on international law, the interpretation is somehow different?
No, Dick, it's not a question of the smart bombs not being smart. They are. But every once in a while, you're going to have a technical problem.
Right.
You're going to have a faulty circuit board. You're going to have something that's going to happen. That is unavoidable. You and I know that we have technology that causes us problems all the time in your studio, in my studio, in our home appliances. Now, that's not to say that the equipment, we should throw it out the window. Neither should we do that with the interpretation of law. I think international humanitarian law demands that we become as precise as we possibly can in our targeting, again, with a fundamental reason to protect civilians and protect civilian objects in a time of armed conflict. But that does not mean that we can have 100% accuracy all the time. All we can do is hope and pray that we do it as much of the time as we can.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Concord, Massachusetts now. Mary's joining us. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Dick. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I heard General Traynor speaking at Holy Cross last night about war and the Christian conscience, and many of the things he spoke about are very consistent with what you're saying today, and it's interesting to hear you both come up with the same perspective, and I've heard it twice in 2 days.
Huh.
But my question is, my understanding of the International Court is that it really is a proponent of just war and many of the Geneva Conventions and all the things you're talking about. But the United States has decided not to participate in the court, which to me seems a little inconsistent. I know there's political reasons for it. But I'd like your clarification on that. And if you think that the U.S. just doesn't think it's a good idea, period, and there shouldn't be one, or that the U.S. for some reason shouldn't participate in it, but they fundamentally feel that the idea is just.
Scott, there's a good one for you.
Yeah, it is. Mary raises an interesting and extremely complex issue of the International Criminal Court. And, Dick, as your listeners know, President Clinton, on the very last day that he could authorize a signing, December 31st of 2000, actually indicated the United States would sign. We did. President Bush, early in the administration, using a vehicle of the Vienna Convention on Treaties, renounced that signature, as it were, and we have taken active steps. Congress has passed legislation that would prohibit foreign aid, would basically say we would go in and fight those countries that hold our troops for prosecution by the ICC.
Mm-hmm.
There are both sides of the debate, Dick. The Department of Defense has clearly said, and Mary raises this, that our troops may be subject to political prosecutions. I tend to think and be a little bit more sanguine about the protections in the ICC statute, particularly Articles 18 and 19 on complementarity, which means if we in the United States initiate any kind of investigation, what's called an Article 32 investigation, or even a preliminary inquiry into charges against our troops, for instance, like in this incident, incident involving the van coming through. That is sufficient to preclude the International Criminal Court from exercising jurisdiction, and we would retain it. But I understand and appreciate the arguments on both sides. The Bush administration and this country has taken the position we will fight the International Criminal Court, and the real question is going to be, will the court survive and prosper and become what has been for many a vision of 50 years ago that needs to be brought into being, a permanent sitting International Criminal Court?
Now, some of those decisions, some of the rulings of the court will end up being a part of international law. Is that right?
You're exactly correct, Dick. International law is derived from, of course, the practice of nations and the writings of scholars, and also the rulings of courts. And, of course, the best example is the 1986 ruling of the International Court of Justice. That's a civilian jurisdiction court, not criminal, as far as the United States assistance to the Contras in Nicaragua. And that opinion has clearly become a part of the fabric of customary international law. International Criminal Court, though, again, and we haven't had a prosecution, its jurisdiction is prospective only. It cannot look past July 1st of last year. It can't go before that. It must look to what's going on now.
But let me ask you another question, Scott. If the issue of the status of the prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay, you've mentioned that a couple of times as kind of a sketchy area as far as other countries are concerned, mm-hmm. in the decisions that have been made politically here in the United States. If that were to go to the Supreme Court of the United States and the Supreme Court were to rule that, yes, the administration is within its rights to call them unlawful combatants and keep them there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, would that then become a part of international law? Because I can imagine, you know, certain countries in the Middle East saying, well, we just don't respect that court and its ruling.
Well, it could be, Dick, but the quick answer to your question is there have already been two court challenges of our courts looking into it in Guantanamo Bay, the district court for the circuit court for the District of Columbia and the Ninth Circuit on the West Coast have both said that our United States federal courts have no jurisdiction to make an inquiry into what we're doing in Guantanamo Bay. And in my judgment, that's a proper ruling based on a Supreme Court decision way back in 1950, Johnson versus Eisentrager. So what we're doing in Guantanamo Bay is certainly in accordance with our domestic law and our courts, an appropriate exercise. The courts have no jurisdiction to inquire into it. That does not mean that we're not subject to a great deal of criticism from even our allies as far as how we've dealt with those folks down there. And there are other international courts that have made rulings regarding that. The United States has not felt that those are controlling on us.
All right. Thanks for that. And Mary, thanks for that question. 1-800-423-8255 to West Boylston, Massachusetts. Now Bruce is with us. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Yeah, my question had to do with the structures for changing the rules of armed conflict. In World War One, we went to war mainly because of German unrestricted warfare, submarine warfare, and 25 years later, we were doing the same thing to the Japanese. Excuse me. And just the opposite happened with gas or, you know, chemical warfare. What are the structures for doing that, and how do the little guys, how does it not become the court of the winner, basically?
Right, or the big power.
Right.
Okay, Scott?
Great question, Bruce. As far as, for instance, the use of gas in armed conflict, chemicals, there are treaties that countries agree to, and the most notable one with regard to chemical weapons is, of course, the Chemical Weapons Convention, which the United States, in fact, signed and ratified as recently as 7 or 8 years ago, which completely prohibits the use of chemical weapons. Biological agents were outlawed by treaty in the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. But with regard to, for instance, what we do in warfare, it's important to recognize, Bruce, that the evolution of international humanitarian law, the rules that we use in armed conflict, came substantially after World War II. The Geneva Conventions, although they were originally in 1929, were fairly substantially revised and republished in 1949, after World War II. Matter of fact, the excesses and the abuses, the carpet bombing of World War II, were a large measure of why the Geneva Conventions were changed. There is the additional protocols 1 and 2 of 1977 to the Geneva Conventions, and the United States has taken some objection to some of those and has not actually signed and adopted the additional protocols of 77, but nonetheless they have become a part of this fabric of customary international law. So the law grows and it tries to learn and adapt to fundamental abuses, but it does not do so on a situational basis as far as what's happening day-to-day in Iraq.
All right, Bruce, thanks for that. Quick last call, if we can get one in from Radcliffe, Kentucky. Gisla's on the line. Hi, Gisla.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I just want to say that I'm really enjoying listening to Scott. He's been very informative, and I can tell that he's really for our soldiers. I have one daughter that's already over there in Kuwait fighting for her country. She's only 18. I have another one that's getting ready to go. And I guess mine is just more or less a comment than a question. I am so appalled at the American people, at how they are so upset over what happened with the 13 women in the van. My heart goes out to those people. I am not one for violence of any kind. And it just seems to me like we're condemning our soldiers for carrying out the job that they were hired to do. These soldiers have families that they want to come home to, too. And I just feel like that our country is not backing them the way that we should.
You think asking questions about it is blaming them, Gisla? I'm not sure that I've heard a lot of people on the program today saying that what they did was wrong or a bad thing, but rather just trying to understand what the rules are that they have to operate under.
Well, and I guess that's my point. There are rules out there, but it's like I think we discuss the situation to death as far as what these soldiers can do and can't do. This is wartime, you know. I mean, and I'm not saying that during war the rules should go out the window, but it's, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm tired of hearing the American public second guess everything that we do, and nothing that Saddam Hussein does to our troops is ever in the news. Those four soldiers that they found in that grave, one of them, the female, her head cut off. I mean, they're doing atrocities to us that it just seems like the press is more in tune as to what's happening to the Iraqi people than
they are. Try and get a last comment from Scott, and Scott, just perhaps a reflection on that sense of frustration that Gisla has.
Well, I think what Gisla is sensing is what a lot of the American people are sensing, that when you have 24 hours day after day of coverage, and many of the networks, I think, in all honesty, are hungry for something to fill the hours. So
yeah,
we tend to get this minutia. But her point is a solid one, that the law is there. We've got to apply the law as best we can. But a reasonable effort to apply the law is all that's being asked for these young soldiers and sailors over there, and airmen and Marines. They are trained. They are fighting as best they can. Obviously, all of us support them, regardless of whether we debate the legal reasons why we got in. It's supporting our troops now and hoping and praying for the quickest conclusion of that so that lives will be not needlessly lost on either side.
Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dick.
Scott Silliman directs the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University Law School in Durham, North Carolina. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Cassettes and CDs of The Connection are available from WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced. Visit us online at www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.